Thanks, everyone. Right. Slight warning. I'm going to have to go fairly fast through here. I've already had to cut so much out that I wanted to talk to you about, so try and cram in what I can. So, who am I? I'm not a railway professional. I'm actually an engineer at a UK particle accelerator, a Diamond Light Source down in Oxfordshire. I gave a talk at EMF last time. I was on a sabbatical at CERN. I talked about CERN technology. So now I'm back in the UK, back at Diamond. But I am, in my spare time, a train infrastructure nerd. And I volunteer at lots of different railway preservation, started with steam railways, then I got into preserving some mainline signalling stuff. And then an opportunity arose to join the team at London Transport Museum Depot, restoring the old ALU systems and learning lots and lots of amazing knowledge and engineering discoveries that occurred and can be preserved there. I'm also a lead for a small open signal box project, which we are producing an open source simulator and hardware for museums and private people to simulate trains on real signal boxes and fake ones and link them together. So that's a lot of fun too. So disclaimer, as I said, I'm not a railway professional. I know a bit about what I'm talking about. I've seen a gaggle of people in underground high-vis yesterday here, so they probably know a lot more than me about certain parts, but I like to think that I've got good heritage knowledge now, so maybe there'll be something for everyone to learn. Also, a lot of the systems that are installed vary by line. Even if it's the same system, it may have been funded at a different time for upgrades, and so it could be a Mark IV versus a Mark I, and therefore things can be different. So don't take anything I say as true for everything. So quick agenda, plugging a book that's just been written on all of this, not by me. Brief intro to the underground for those who aren't familiar, but very brief. Fundamentals of the London Underground signalling, what you'll see on the line side and how it's different from the main line, which I think will be quite interesting for everyone. Some incredible automation that was done, electromechanical, electro-pneumatic in the 1960s, which is really cool, which is what I really want to show you. And then a bit about self-driving trains. I've cut all the computer stuff out, so I hope you're not coming here hoping for computers. This is all going to be mechanical computers. The new stuff is great, but it's commercial. I don't want to talk too much about that. You can probably Google as much as I know about it, so go Wikipedia that. Buy this book if you're interested. Dr. Piers Connor, he's worked in the industry. He's already done a book on motive power and rolling stock. This is a new one on signalling. It's written in conjunction with TfL staff, so it's all very accurate and checked. It's really great. That's a QR code, it's just an Amazon link, nothing malicious, you have to trust me on that. Other resources, some great websites here. I'm just going to freeze frame, so if you want to take a picture, you can. The bottom two links there are really great papers on some of the stuff I'll talk about a bit later and some of the really great engineering inventions. So they're well worth a read. They're not boring, they're very interesting. The underground, it's actually the 45% underground. And I'm not talking about the overground here, some of the underground lines we've got now, you'll notice they run over viaducts. So as originally, lines were built in on the surface to get over the existing buildings. 1937, London and Greenwich Railway, first steam railway into London. Around 50 years later, the subsurface lines. This is the construction, it's called cut and cover. You've probably heard that phrase before. Take the road up and you lay the track underneath. This is a really interesting place. It's Leinster Gardens. And they had essentially a cutting they could use, but there was a set of buildings that went over. And so in order to keep with the road, they built a fake frontage. So if you go and visit that in London, you can just about see around the sides that it is fake. And you can see it on Google Maps too. It's still there. And then around, again, 50 years later, we have the deep level line. So these are the tube tunnels. This is why it's called the tube, because they're round tunnels. The subsurface are quite often more archy shaped, especially in the station areas. But the tubes were built with the Great Head Shield. So this was invented by one of Brunel's senior engineers when they did the original Under Thames passenger tunnel and then later train tunnels. Who ran the tube? Well, originally it was these railway companies that drove into London, and there was a huge plethora of them. And so you can see here a big list of them. They did a lot of the original building with private members' bills through Parliament to get access, and then private funding and investment. However, they found that some of this funding was hard to get later on, and they wanted to electrify the district line, so get rid of the steam trains. And they'd started to drill the tube lines, but they were running out of money. So this is the Bakerloo, Northern and Piccadilly, as they're called nowadays. And so Charles Yerkes, an American financier, he'd already done the Chicago Tramway. He was persuaded to come over and invested and got a lot of overseas investments, that's not a new thing, to finish off those. And because of that, so he formed the Underground Electric Railways of London, which then became the London Underground as a company. And he started a bit of standardization because, you know, then owned a lot of them. So Charles Holden and Leslie Green, two famous architects that we used for it. Leslie Green, responsible for these lovely terracotta maroon tile station fronts. Then to the present day, they found that they absorbed everything, this company. They then got the buses, the trolley buses, the trams, and they found they got a lot of competition from lots of small unregulated bus companies. And they were very pally with the government by then, Parliament, because they were the big company. And so they persuaded them to introduce regulation, and they created the London Passenger Transport Board. This wasn't nationalisation, it was a public-owned company. But of course, there were a lot of people who owned the underground company who then got shares in the LPTB. And that pushed out all of those small companies. Then a bit later, 1948, it nationalised. And both of those were under the guise of London Transport. This logo down here, and then with the Greater London Authority reorganisation under Ken Livingstone, it then turned into Transport for London in the millennium. Right, that's the history of the Underground. On to the signalling. I'm doing a quick one-slide signalling intro. I'm just assuming you have some railway signalling knowledge, very light. There are other talks this year and previous years that go into that more in detail. As far as I'm concerned, the signalling does about four things. One is we have the signals, which gives drivers permission to proceed and warns of the state of other signals ahead. We have the points, which change the route of the train. These have to be interlocked with the signals so that you can't give a clear signal to cross over points that are set wrong, etc. Protects trains. Train detection, so this is where we want to know where the trains are, and this is important when we're signalling larger areas where a signalman pulling levers can't just see that the train isn't outside. So we use electrical systems to detect those. That then gets fed into the interlocking to make sure that the signals also know that information. It's much more reliable to do it that way. And then train describers, so this is where, although we might know a train is somewhere, we don't know which one it is. So the train describer system tracks the movement of specific trains, which is important if your next signal box needs to know where to send a train. If it's got the order of the trains wrong, it might send the wrong train the wrong way and the passengers aren't very happy. Nowadays, in the main line, these feed into delay repay systems as well. So it's a very expensive system to keep working well. If you get it wrong, then it can be quite financially expensive. Early signalling on the Underground. So it followed the mainline practice as it came into the city. So we see typical manufacturers for the mainline, Sykes, Mackenzie and Holland, Saxby and Farmer. We have some steam lines here. So the circle line on the inner circle, some semaphore signals and a conventional signal box here. We have Rickmansworth on the Met line. These have got these lovely balanced signal arms. And then Earlscourt in the district, a conventional gantry. So very similar to what you see on the main line. But then they want to go into tunnels, and these don't fit very well in tunnels, as you can see from here. So on the left picture, we have King William Street. This is the first tube line, and it's very closed by now. But we have some very stubby semaphore signals to start the trains off from the two sides of the platform. But they do have the spectacle plates. So these are the coloured lenses that go in front of the lamp to make it red or green. Although back then it was just about green, but they started off as white and red, but then it turned into green and red. But they then said, well, there's no point with the semaphore arms, no one can see them, they're just looking at the coloured light. So then they just moved the spectacle plate, and in the middle here we have Finsbury Park and the Pick Line in 1906, and this is just lifting the spectacle plate up and down with a paraffin lamp behind. But the problem they found is that the draft in these closed tube tunnels was blowing out the paraffin lamp. And they just about had enough reliable electric supply to light an electric lamp, which was only bright enough for use in a tunnel at that time. But it did work. So you had tunnel lamps. So here on the right, we've got one from Paddington in 1913, still there in 2024, working well. This is really interesting, actually. It's one of the Westinghouse's first tunnel signals like this. And to make, rather than switch between red and green on a relay, which we'd normally do now, they use this flux neutralizer circuit, which sounds very EMF. And essentially, your red light, which is your safety light, you always want it to be able to light up, was always powered. And when it powered the green light, it had a winding which would cancel out the current in the red lamp. So the red lamp was always powered, and it was only if the green turned off that the red would then be allowed to light again. But if you had a failure, then the red should still stay lit. Nowadays, our systems are reliable enough and proven that we know we don't have to do that circuit. You'll notice in the middle here, this is actually activated by electropneumatics, and I'll go into that in a bit later. It's definitely a big London Underground thing. So then we have multiple aspect signalling. This is outside. So I mentioned that the lamps weren't bright enough for use outside. This is true on the main line as well. But then we got to the state where Westinghouse and other companies invented the Fresnel lens on a signal head. So this takes all of the light radiated by the bulb and as much as possible cuts the lens in a lot of different angles so that we can shoot the light forwards. I don't think we have any Fresnels in this lighting rig, but in theatre lights, this is another trick that you play with Fresnel theatre lights. So on the left, you see the original ones, which had a single hood for each signal. So each one of these could go red or green. Then what happened is they decided that they did these nice Fresnel lenses, they could shoot the light forwards, focus it, and use it outside. They put individual hoods on, and at that point, they had a worry that snow might build up on a hood and obscure the lamp above. And that's where, for the first time, they decided to put red light at the bottom so you'd never get snow built underneath. And that's why railway signals, one of the reasons railway signals have the red light at the bottom, yellow in signalling, and then green at the top, whereas in traffic signals, it's the other way around. Interestingly, the road traffic signals were taken from railway signals. Firstly, a semaphore at a crossing in London, operated by a policeman. Then they switched to a gas or oil-powered lamp, which exploded and killed the policeman. So they then got rid of it for a while. And then when they got the electric supply in, they put it back in again, and the rest is history. So you also notice here, you have this little side light. This is called a pig's ear, because it looks like a pig's ear. And this is such that, remember I said the lens was focused so that you could see it far away with a low-powered lamp? If you draw up to the signal to stop at the red, you then can't see the lamp anymore because it's all focused away from you. So the pig's ear lets you see that. Interestingly with this is a modern Fresnel lens, which is suitable for mainline use as well. You'll notice there's this sort of 45 degree angle where you can see some of the light. This is called a hot strip, and it's where the Fresnel lens is flatter. And in the main line, you just have that, and that lets you see the light from drawn up close. But in the London Underground, they also had the pig's ear because originally they didn't have that special hybrid lens. So what else have we got here? On the right-hand side, we see a junction indicator, a route indicator. On the London Underground, they have three white lights. On the main line, it's five, or can be a single bar now with some of the modern LED signals. So this lets the driver know that they're taking a diverging route and they have to run at a reduced speed. The driver has route knowledge to know all of the different speeds for these junctions. There's also a few other bits which we will cover in a second, so I won't go through them now. Other things you see on the tube, signalling, rail gap indicators, this is very interesting. So if the electricity in front is cut for some reason, either intentionally for maintenance or because there's been an issue, these will light up with three red lights. They also have a repeater in case your braking distance isn't long enough for sighting that signal, and that's in yellow, and it will be before you see the indicator. What's fun with these is that they're treated as a red stop signal because your train will get gapped or you will run out of juice if you go over it. But depending on the line and the operational rules, sometimes they get permission to jump the gap, in which case the instruction is to motor up as hard as you can and jump over. But it all depends on the line and the rule book, but it's interesting. Repeaters. So this is something that, if you look at the signalling on the underground, might confuse you the most, especially this signal on the right-hand side here. So on the London Underground, they don't really have distance signals, per se. On mainline signalling, if all of your normal signals are clear through a station, a distant will clear, and that lets the driver know they don't have to slow down. But they do have repeaters, and this you have permanent repeaters where the sighting of the next signal might be too short, either around a corner or there's an obstruction. In the London Underground, they stack them. So this is not a four-aspect signal like on the main line with two yellows and things like that. It's actually a red and green signal at the top, and then there's a green and yellow signal, sorry, beneath below, which tells you the state of the next signal ahead. And then below that, we also have a fog repeater for the next signal ahead. And fog repeaters are used for signals which normally wouldn't need their own repeater, but in foggy conditions, depending on the location, if it's being open place or somewhere that fog's liable to come in, then they used to be enabled by the signaler, but nowadays they're all wired to be permanently on. So they normally nowadays have a black letter F etched in the glass when the next signal is at red, or just green when it isn't. So shunt signals, so these are electro-pneumatic signals. They're getting replaced with electrical lit ones, but you still see a lot of these now. These are rotating discs, very similar to the mainline shunt signals, at least older style. And they are normally accompanied by a route indicator here. So this is a theater type indicator with lots of lamps, and that will tell the driver which platform, in this case, they're driving into with their train. So these are electro-pneumatic. I'm going to talk about that in a little while. Points, just getting through the other infrastructure you'll see. Electro-pneumatic, so this is where rather than use, they didn't have enough reliable power to drive point motors and physical drives. I know they're driving trains with the traction power, but that's different. So they didn't have enough signaling power to drive those reliably, but they used air. And the air, which I'll talk about in a second, came from the American system that they brought over. But they effectively, they're air-operated. They're initially mounted, were mounted on the wall. Then they were put between the rails, or in the forefoot, as it's called. And then the more modern versions are chairlock points, where these are now built in an even smaller footprint. And then nowadays, they're starting to switch everything out to electric. So they were originally trialed in 1924, the Westinghouse electric machine. It took three times as long to move the points as the main line. And in the underground, trains move very quickly, especially at interchanges. So that three times as long, those extra seconds, did count. Also, they didn't like the fact that it was a complicated machine with lots of parts from another company, whereas they could maintain the air-operated ones in-house, and they were very, very simple. However, in 1990, sort of corporate pressure to buy off the shelf came in a bit more, and they had faster machines. They're still slower than the airwork points, but they are much faster now. And nowadays, we even have in-bearer solutions. This means it's hidden inside a single sleeper on the bottom right here. And this is really great for track maintenance, because if they have, you know, packing machines or anything that they have to go between the sleepers, they don't have to make an exception when they get to the point. As much of an exception. Electro-pneumatics. So, as I mentioned, everything runs on air. And this is because Charles Yerkes, when he started UERL, brought over Westinghouse Company from the US, who had just done the Boston Elevated Railway, to sort out the signalling. And Westinghouse Brake and Signal Company made brakes and signals, but they started with air brakes, and a lot of modern trains use derivatives of Westinghouse air brakes, and then they use the same technology on the signalling. So each location, each signalling location, station should I say, or signal box as well, have their own air compressor. This generates around 60 psi at that location. It goes, there's a pipe on each side, an eastbound and a westbound, or a northbound, southbound. It's the silver pipe on the top of all the cable runs you see out the window when you're commuting. And whenever there's something that needs it, a rubber pipe will drop down from that and it will go into one of these things, which is a glass enclosed electro-pneumatic valve. And this electrical cable will go in, and it's just a solenoid valve, really. And so you can see an example here. So the shunt signals actually have them mounted on the back, but the points don't. So on the side here, you'll see there's a little one here and a little one here. And they've got a glass window, so you can look inside and check they're all happy. But, you know, play this game, try and spot them whenever you see bits of infrastructure. So yes, there we go. Controlling the signals. You've talked about the stuff you see on the side. How do they work? How do they get moved? So again, we started with conventional lever frames, same manufacturers as before. The Metropolitan line, being quite a long run, all the way up to Buckinghamshire, to Quainton Road originally, a huge distance out, they retained mainline signals for a lot longer and big levers, because they sort of were operating a mainline railway out there, really. A nice example I give is Boston Manor Station on the Piccadilly. The signal box is still there. It only was open for 20 years. It's been closed for 120 years, and it's still there. So it's very impressive. I have covered this already, but just to recap, Westinghouse Brick and Signal Company, this is the Boston Elevated Railway, and they brought the technology over. But to control the electro-pneumatic system, you don't need big levers anymore, because you don't need to pull wires and push rods. You just need to move electrical contacts, which then send the electrical signal to operate those valves I just showed you. So the frames can be much, much smaller, which means you can fit more levers in, etc. So they look a bit like this. This is how they work. What we have is the lever at the top here with a little catch handle to stop it snapping back of its own accord. This then has its motion transferred down at the front where there's a rack of mechanical interlocking, and I'll talk about this in a minute. This is how you implement the basic rules to stop collisions. And then what it also does is it connects to a shaft that rotates along the back. Those go to electric locks, and those interact with the track circuits, which I will tell you about in a minute. This is making sure that trains aren't, for example, sat over the points when you want to move them. So that's another level of locking. And then at the back, we have the contact pieces. So these are the bits that just measure the position of the lever and then actuate the different valves and circuits. So this is what it looks like with the cover off. And these are some of the original sort of style K frames that they had. Lovely ornate wooden case, piece of glass in front of the interlocking so you can inspect it. And on the right hand side, we've got some train describers, which I might have time to talk to you about. And then we see a more advanced system. This is a style N. On this one, you can see behind the levers, we've got little red lamps. These tell you if the signals are at red. Or at danger, on as it's called in lingo, if the signal clears or is off, then the lamp extinguishes. Because all the signaler needs to know is if it's stopping the train or not. Doesn't matter what other aspect it is. Although in London Underground, it's normally only green because it's mostly two-aspect signaling. An interesting part on the right-hand side, if you look underneath one of these frames, you have these interesting linkages. These are sort of breakaway linkages. So rather than an errant signaler yanking a lever and breaking some of this finely tuned mechanical interlocking, which I'll show you in the next slide, they actually snap the lever, and then that's much easier to fix than it is to do the next bit. Interlocking. So this is used in the main line as well as London Underground. It's much smaller and neater on the miniature frames, and it's easier to work with. So this essentially is a set of metal sliding bars, which allows you to implement logic rules. It's a bit like a sliding puzzle game. So for example, so on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, it's the same system. It's in different states. So we start on the left, and we've got lever number one, which comes across the top row, is normal, so it's in its back position, and lever number seven is also in its back position. And this thing in the vertical part has this little wedge. They're called cats and dogs in London Underground parlance. And if you were to move lever one forwards, as you can see, it's now slid across. And this means that this vertical part can't move up now. Why would it want to move up? Well, if you wanted to pull lever seven, it would slide it upwards. So when both of them are back, you can pull either of them. If you pull any one of them, it will block the other one from moving. And this is how you implement the rules. It doesn't just have to be on the adjacent levers. As you can see here, this is one and seven. So really, there's going to be six others in the middle. Five others in the middle. Saturday. So that's mechanical interlocking. In the mainline railways, we've moved away from this now. As you'll see, Robert Dull, the chief engineer who made some amazing automation inventions, he always stayed with it because he knew that it was very, very reliable and would save his bacon if he invented something that had a mistake in it. So let me talk a bit about track circuits. So this is how do we detect where the train is. The basic principle is the same as we have on the main line. These were copied from the US. Even before Yerkes and all of that, they were invented in the United States track circuits. What we do is we take, I think it's big enough to see a bit up there, sorry if it isn't. We take a battery, because back then signal boxes just had local batteries, they didn't have mains everywhere, and they get swapped out and topped up. And we put it across the rails, so it only has to be 10 volts, maybe a bit less. That goes down the two rails. Where they're connected, it's an insulated joint. So it used to be wooden blocks, nowadays it's plastic and different polymers. The current or the voltage goes down those rails, and if there isn't a train there, at the other end we have another insulated joint, and we connect it to a relay. And so normally it will energize that relay. We pick the relay, we pull the contact up, and that proves that there isn't anything on the track. So it's proving that the track is clear, not that there is something there. It's a fail-safe way of doing it. If our power supply dies for some reason, the relay will fall away. Right? And this is the same as if we had a train there, because a train wheel being cast iron will short out that circuit. So instead of going through the relay, it will go through the train wheels. So the relay also falls away. And because of that short circuit, we have some series resistors. That's why they're in the diagram, to make sure we don't blow our battery up. And that's the basic premise. We have to watch out because of ballast resistance. So the sleepers and the stone or concrete between them isn't infinitely insulating. So there's a leakage current there, and a lot of setting up track circuits is balancing all of this. That puts a limit to how long they can be as well, because the longer it is, the more of a parallel resistance we have reducing that effect. This brings us on to the number of rails we have on the tube. So four rails. It's very, very rare to have four rails on modern transit systems. The reason why they went for four rails is because they were a bit worried about the amount of power that would leak through this balance resistance. So the main two rails that the train sits on are not mounted on porcelain insulators, which the other two ones are. Right, you have to be able to take the weight of a train, so you can't sit them on porcelain insulators. The traction rails are mounted on porcelain insulators, so they don't, they've got a very high insulation to go through the ground. Originally, they didn't think they'd have enough power to leak it all through the ground and waste it, so that's why they decided to have two dedicated rails. It also made implementing the original DC track circuits much simpler, because you didn't have any traction DC on the rails you want to use for your track circuit that might falsely pick up your relay, which is not what you want, because then it will pretend that there isn't a train there when there really is. So this made the DC track circuit possible in the London Underground. Later, they invented a three-rail DC track circuit system, which is where they said, you know what, we don't need to cut both rails. We can actually have one continuous rail, and then we can only insulate and cut sections up in the other rail. And that way, the DC traction current goes down the third rail and the common rail, the continuous rail, and the track circuit goes across the other two. It's still not perfect, and that's why they invented AC track circuits. And so what we can do instead is say that the track circuit uses an alternating current, and then the traction that powers the train uses DC. And that way, they can't falsely interfere with each other. But how can you make a relay that's sensitive to AC back in the 1900s? And it was a very clever invention called the vane relay. It takes a sheet of metal and puts it between these electromagnet poles, solenoid poles, and they use shaded poles with little copper rings, and that slightly offsets the fields, and you get an eddy current in the plate, and then by positioning it correctly, effectively you're creating an electric motor. It's a bit like a stepper motor that self-inducts. And then it moves this around, and that then closes contacts. Very clever invention. So it's immune to the DC of the traction. Then they found that you could only do this a certain distance, because these relays, they're great, but they're very power hungry. So they take about 45 watts sometimes, which is a lot for a relay. So if you had a very long track section, you'd actually lose a lot of it through this ballast resistance, and you wouldn't be able to pick up the relay. So they invented another type called the dual element, which had two coils that made this. It's a biphase motor. They had a local supply, which was a lot beefier because it wasn't going down the track, and then you had your track supply that came in, the track feed that came off the track, and that would then enable it to lift. What was really clever with that is that the two feeds had to be 90 degrees out of phase, and that was set up with a capacitor in series with the track system. If it wasn't, then it wouldn't work, and that's good because it meant that if you accidentally shorted your local feed to your track input, it wouldn't work because it wasn't 90 degrees out of phase. So it was a very clever system there. These are big. They're known as fish tank relays, these glass enclosed relays. This is Harrow on the Hill relay room, so it's absolutely full. But they're lovely. They're really easy to maintain. The mechanisms are all exploded. They're huge inside there, and they're nice to tweak and calibrate. Right, automatic signaling. Now we have track circuits, and we have signals. Why, if we have a plain section of line, we don't need a signaler to just sit there and change the signals all the time. As long as we know the train's clear, we can set it to green. So we have an automatic system that has some basic rules to clear them. And I'm short for time, so I'm not going to explain anymore. We have another thing in the London Underground called king levers. So this is where if you have a station that, say, has, I don't know, three platforms or has a reversing siding, but for a lot of the time you don't use that. You only use that in peak hours. What you can do is set the signals up to just go straight through and not use the reversing siding, pull the magic blue lever, And this will set the whole system into a mode where it will automatically clear the signals again. So it switches it out into automatic mode. The signals have a light underneath which lights up A if it's, that's the case, because for a controlled signal, you have a telephone. So if it's red and for a long time, you call the signaler and say, why am I still stuck here? That's also to make sure they know that you're there and don't send something into the back of you. Not that that should happen, but just in case, because it has in the past with various incidents. If there's no signaler in the box, then you're not going to be able to call them. So the A tells them that this is acting now as an automatic signal, and you are actually allowed to pass it after a time limit, very slowly, expecting to perhaps meet a train around the corner. That's what the king lever's for, and the A light is for. Now, what have I missed? This is a question for you in the room. Tube knowledge. What's a fundamental part on the London Underground signalling?
Trip cocks.
Thank you very much. Train stops and trip cocks. Well done, that man. So, the whole premise of underground signalling and the way the wiring is designed is actually all around train stops and trip cocks. Metro trains, underground trains, go fairly slow compared to mainline. You're normally looking around 25 miles an hour. And so what this means is that if you slam the brakes on, if you hit an emergency brake application, the train stops very quickly. And this means you can take some liberties that they can't take in the mainline. And one of the things is by having this train stop system, which is linked to the red aspect of the signal, to say that, you know, you do not have any authority to proceed, you can stop the train with a high degree of certainty. And all the signalling circuits are really designed so that that's the first-class citizen, the train stop. Mainline, it's very different. The red aspect of the light, signal light, is the first-class citizen. It's proven to be lit before anything else can happen, and all the other warning systems sit on top of that. Whereas on the underground, it's the train stop that is key. It operates a trip cock on the train, so it literally opens a hole in the brake pipe, which allows it to vent, and then it puts all the brakes on. You've probably seen and heard them. If you're at the platform end of a station, it will go hiss, and you'll see this little thing go down or up. They're normally up, which will operate the trip cock. You can see the trip cock painted in white here. It's fail-safe. It will raise up if the air supply dies. And this is what it looks like when it trips. So you'll see it hits the arm and then it knocks the trip cock back and that vents the brakes. They have to test them because when they first put them in, they found that these vertical arms sometimes were bent and then it just misses the thing it's supposed to hit. And that unfortunately did cause problems. So they have trip cock testers. On the right hand side, you'll see there's these two little gate posts. It has to go through the middle, and if it goes through the middle, it then hits a ramp. That then depresses and it extinguishes a light, and the driver sees that. These are on the exits to depots and at various other places. And if it doesn't extinguish, then they have to inspect it and take the train out of service. Right. Oh, wow, I've got 4 minutes. Very quick. Speeding up the service. We have route setting frames. This meant that rather than pulling points and signals, we just pull or push, and it, say, sends it into platform one or platform two. We then took into remote frames. So now we say, rather than having to have signalers everywhere, let's have it so that we can operate them remotely and build them into an extended lever frame. And they did this with little air cylinders that would actually move the levers. So again, we're preserving the mechanical interlocking. So we have all of the rules baked in to be safe, but we're operating it remotely. What they did find is that because it's so finely tuned, it would actually lock up. This engineer, Mr. Kent, decided on the circuit that would actually do a first air puff to move the lever halfway and then a second puff called the Kent circuit. So you get these two puffs. It's very fun to watch. Anyway, here's an example from Harrow on the Hill of a remote frame. The controlling levers are on the left. This is the Harrow on the Hill section. And then North and South Harrow on this end of the frame. And you can see the signaler's moving the levers at this end. And these levers are moving automatically. They don't have catch handles. And it's restroking the route. So there we go. Now, you don't need to operate it then with levers because it's all electrical. We can use push buttons. So they then have push button desks. There are a lot of these around. You push to set a route and you pull to cancel it. Dal then invented with Westinghouse the V-style frame because we had to try and fit these inside tube tunnels. They wanted to put these in all of the ends of station doors. They were called interlocking machine rooms, squeeze them in. So he took that signal lever frame and he unfolded it to make it vertical. And you've got these stubby little levers here, contact bands on the top and mechanical locking at the bottom. Then what he did is he said, well, actually, we don't need people anymore because they found out that their timetables were pretty reliable. And what they did was they took a pianola roll from a piano and they actually put the entire timetable on it. It's incredible. And so this was an amazing invention. It would rewind automatically at 3 a.m. If they had a different service because of a football special or something, some person would go around in a van and have to swap them all over. But just to show you what they look like, so we have the time that the train should leave encoded in holes here. We have the route that should be set by the signaling system. We have the train number, the identity, and its description to display on the platform. And if the train number was wrong, there was the very first time division multiplex system would actually encode all of these inputs and outputs and send it to a control room. For example, for the Northern and Victoria Line, this was Coburg Street in Euston, which is a lovely big wraparound control room. The amazing invention of technology. I will come back and do another talk on the Victoria Line stuff because it's incredible. One slide on it. It's the world's first passenger-carrying automatic driving train, train operation. The one before it was the mail rail, which you can go and ride on, but that wasn't passenger-carrying. So this had a lot more safety because it was carrying people. They used coded track circuits. So the track circuits from before, they chopped them up a few hertz and then a few more hertz. It's all under 10 hertz. It's all in counts per minute, so 180 counts per minute, 270. They didn't trust electronic circuitry as well then, and crystal oscillators, so they were actually swinging pendulums, which is very cool, which then triggered the switches. And then the trains would pick that up on coils and then control their braking and accelerating on it. And then to have smooth braking in the platform, they had these little spot generators, which ran at different sort of 5, 6, 7 kilohertz, and they'd have that on the rail, and it would only propagate a few feet, and that would be detected by a different antenna. And so, for example, you see here we'd have 420 codes, and then as we approach a train in the station, the different codes that are sent from the knowledge of the track circuits would change to slow the train down. We also have a spot brake command to slow down for the station, and inside the station there'd be many different brake commands that would have a smooth halt. Special signalling on these systems, there would be a white aspect as well, and this means that only a train under automatic driving can pass. It means there's a train ahead before the next physical signal that the driver wouldn't be able to see, but the auto system knows because it has more track circuits than there are signals, so it's safe for the auto to proceed, but not for a driver because they wouldn't be able to see it. This is the same on the central line. This was also an ALU-developed system. It uses a slightly different system. It uses frequency-shifted keying for the track circuits, but they have white lights as well, and you can see those a lot. You know, what is a white signal? It means an automatic train can proceed. It was so easy to drive, you just had to push two buttons to close the doors, and the train would drive itself, that even Queen Elizabeth drove it, and she opened it, and she looked very happy doing it. There's an amazing simulator online, written by my friend Paul Sweetland. He's got a museum in the Colne Valley Railway in Castle Headingham in Essex. He has written in Perl an entire simulation of all the book wiring and all the relays. It's got program machines that are animated, lever boards. Please go and have a look at his website. You can crash it and break it. It respawns every now and then. Have fun with it. But it explains how it all works. So that's really amazing. Thank you very much for listening.